Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and tonight I wanted to do something slightly different to the usual format. You know, if you're a follower of the podcast, that from time to time I do interviews, and normally the topic areas are pertain very closely to some fairly kind of well-trodden paths that we do on here, looking at international history, particularly 20th century history as it pertains to things like war. But one of the key areas that I feel is always overlooked, always neglected, and is of enormous importance to the way we live our lives now is the question of the accumulation of media power in the 20th century. And the 21st century, in fact. Now, you might be listening from the UK, you might be further afield, but wherever you are, there is a version of this story playing out, whether you are in the Anglophone world or somewhere else, there is a version of this story. And here we talk about Britain's now broken system of politics and the effect that media ownership and media consolidation has had on creating that.
Okay. So I'm introducing tonight to the Explaining History podcast Mick Wright, a journalist and writer who has a daily newsletter that I subscribe to, Conquest of the Useless, which passes a kind of a critical eye on the media and the kind of the interplay between media and British politics. Now, the reason why I wanted to focus on this evening, as I was discussing with Mick before we started, was that a greatly overlooked aspect of British public life, and I'm sure you can find this around the rest of the world, is the extent of and growth of media power in Great Britain. And Mick has kindly come on this evening to talk a little bit about how we've reached the state of affairs that we are when media power is concentrated so tightly in a small number of hands in the United Kingdom. Thank you, Mick. So at the moment, of course, the British print media, obviously, and digital media, has a huge amount of sway with the government of the day. And throughout the last 100 years, really, there's been a kind of an established pattern of this, hasn't there?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you look back to the kind of media barons of the early 20th century, you know, some of whose descendants are still operating within the media environment now. If you look at Lord Rothermere, the current Lord Rothermere, and his predecessors, his father and grandfather being the Rothermere of Hurrah for the Black Shirts. You look back to those days, and there was certainly already a sense of these powerful media barons who could put pressure on governments, who could ensure that the interests of their class were well served by government through using the newspapers they had as a power base. And then you go down through into the later on, out of the 50s, into the 60s, into the 70s, and you look at Rupert Murdoch coming in to the UK in the late 60s. But really, he really gets his power in the UK when he is allowed to take over the Times and Sunday Times, something that competition regulators had been preventing before, but which the Thatcher government allowed because Murdoch was a big cheerleader for the Thatcher government. And at that point, that's the point when consolidation of ownership goes, really happens in a big way. And in recent years, we've seen even more consolidation of ownership because Reach, which is a sort of amorphous mass of local and national newspapers, which used to be Trinity Mirror, owns a huge number of papers now because the papers that had been owned by Richard Desmond, who's moved out of the newspaper world, they're now owned by that. So it's very condensed, and that means as well that you end up having a very narrow political perspective among papers. Really, yeah. I mean, people would still say that the Observer and the Guardian are of the left, but I think possibly quite a lot of people who are more of the left than them would argue that those papers are really more at best a centre, centre left at best, but more just kind of a pure centrist paper. So the plurality of views has gone as well, and that's a problem.
Sure. So the centre of gravity in terms of discourse has moved to the right. The line that editors of things like The Sun always say is that they don't set agendas, they reflect them. They reflect views that are already there. Various kind of media theorists would dispute that. Is there any actual validity in that argument?
I mean, it's manifestly untrue. So at a lower level, what you hear a lot from columnists is no one tells me what to write. But, I've used this clip in a couple of newsletters since I started doing the newsletter in June last year. But, there's an interview from the mid-90s between when Andrew Marr was still a newspaper editor but was doing an interview show for the BBC, and he's interviewing Noam Chomsky, and Andrew Marr says, but I don't. Nobody tells me, I'm able to have my own opinions. But Noam Chomsky says, but if you had different opinions, you wouldn't be allowed to sit where you're sitting. So the reality about it is A, the newspapers select people with opinions that fit the prevailing editorial tone of the paper. But also, when you're within a newspaper, I've worked in newspapers. I was a sort of token centre, soft left person for the Telegraph for a short while, writing on their comment desk as a freelancer, and although I was allowed to write broadly left kind of things, there's in your head where the limits are. You don't have to have the limits told to you. And when it comes to the editors, Rupert Murdoch, we do know, will tell editors this was crap, that was crap, change this, change that. Rothermere would argue that he didn't tell Paul Dacre to do what to do when Paul Dacre was editor of the Daily Mail, but editors know why they've been hired and what their proprietors want. I guess the best way, in one way you could look at editors and say they're a bit like football managers, right? The proprietor, they know what is required to make the proprietor happy, and you keep your job as long as you keep the proprietor happy.
Yeah. Okay. And so they're good at understanding the subtext. There is this, a great deal written in various biographies of Rupert Murdoch, particularly about his relationship with, the British establishment, that he felt in about 1968 snubbed because he didn't receive a knighthood, and he'd published, Christine Keeler's diaries, and he always has presented himself as this sort of slightly more plebeian kind of character. outsider who is not one of the toffs. I mean, looking into his biography, there's a big kind of question marks over that claim. But I mean, how far do you think anybody who operates in that sort of role, that sort of position, can really claim to be a political outsider?
Well, I mean, in one sense, Murdoch is literally an outsider, isn't he? Because he's in he's born in Australia. He's this Australian who comes over to the UK and then latterly to the US and becomes a massive power broker in these countries where he is literally an outsider. But in another way, his father was a newspaper owner. He has something in common with Trump, which is, although actually, unlike Trump, Murdoch has made a vastly bigger success of the business that was, that he gained. He started out with newspapers that his father had owned previously. So in that sense, he comes from an elite class within Australia. But then it would be fair to say that the Britain of the late 60s would have looked at a Antipodean upstart like him, and it didn't really, so, you know, because to the rich in England particularly, it doesn't matter if you've got to be more than just rich, you know. Yeah. To the upper classes, it doesn't matter how rich Rupert Murdoch is, he'll always be a pleb because he's sort of new money, you know, because his money doesn't come from, you know, isn't hundreds of years in the making.
Yeah.
But is he part of the elite? Yes, because he has power to make the elite jump for him because they understand the power of his media operations. Yeah. And the papers he has now are much less influential, but you've got to look at the way he's now moved more strongly into radio, is looking to launch a new news channel now that he divested himself out of Sky News, which he had to do in the sale to Fox of other properties and stuff. But he still has this media power base. He's building more, you know, he's just building it in TV and radio now.
There was, a moment, at around the time of the phone hacking scandal and the Leveson inquiry, where there seemed to be a kind of the glimmer of a possibility of some kind of regulation, some kind of curb on the power, not just of the Murdoch empire, but of the right wing, the right side of Fleet Street in general. What happened there? Why did that not occur?
I have this thing where I compare the media and the way the media works to professional wrestling. And in professional wrestling, you have two broad types of character, right? You have faces and heels, and like a face is a good guy and a heel is a bad guy. Well, they also have this thing called a work, right? Which is like a kind of thing where it seems like it's real, but it's not. It's a kind of, it's a thing that you're doing to give the audience a certain impression. And for me, the Leveson inquiry, and this is not to say that Lord Leveson was not taking it seriously, or those, or the legal minds that were involved in Leveson weren't taking it seriously, but ultimately government wasn't. Government never really, what they wanted to do was they wanted the problem of phone hacking off the table, and they wanted to have been seen to do something. And we all know this in politics, there can be a big gulf between being seen to do something and doing something, you know, and that's, for me, it was a work. It was never going to be fully undertaken. And Leveson 2, which was going to look at the relationship between the press and the police, never happened. And bribes to police and bribes to public officials and all that kind of stuff. That could have been sensationally damaging, right? And it never happened. Just went in the long grass.
My sense at the time was that was kind of verging on Birmingham 6 territory, when those sorts of revelations would come out, you know.
Yeah, and that would have been a lot of the meat of the material. But the other thing to remember is, look, Rebecca Brooks was, went to court, was found innocent of various charges around the phone hacking stuff. There was a lack of evidence around that, and it couldn't be proved that she knew certain things. And look, a smart... pushing her to one side for a second, one thing that smart operators in many industries know is don't put your name in the emails, don't write stuff down. If you're asking for or discussing tricky things or things that might be on the edge of what you should be doing, you don't write it down. And I think some people in those organizations made the mistake of writing things down and others didn't.
Yeah.
But look, she's now back as the chief executive of News UK. So, you know, the big fish didn't get caught in Leveson. Little drunken, screwed up, horrible little reporter guys, Neville Thirlbecks of this world. You know, Paul, whatever his name was, I forget his name now. There's another reporter who was forever on the TV, absolutely drunk, just admitting all the stuff he'd done and going, yeah, but nobody really cared, you know, as if that was going to protect him somehow. The little fish got done, the blaggers got done, all those kind of people. But the executive level didn't get touched. And when Murdoch said in the parliament, to the parliamentary committee after Leveson, you know, this is the most humble day of my life and all this kind of stuff, it's just for show. It's just, yeah. Nothing happened to Rupert Murdoch. He got a pie in the face from Johnny Marbles at that, you know, custard pie. That's the worst thing that happened to him. And he had to shut the news of the world. But what happened when he shut the news of the world was 2 weeks later, what opened up, but The Sun on Sunday, which is the news of the world, you know, without the balls to admit what it really is.
Yeah. What do you think now, here we are in 2021, what is the prospects of a functioning democracy in Great Britain in the shadow of this immense kind of accumulation of media power?
Yeah, I think we are operating in a very broken system. It's not just media power, it's because think tank, when you have a government that is led by someone like Boris Johnson, who has really doesn't really believe in much other than the accrual of power for power's sake, doesn't really have any consistent policies. He's not a conviction politician. Like, you look at some, I think the last conviction politician we had was, I don't know, John Major possibly, Margaret Thatcher possibly. Not that I liked the things that were their convictions, but they sort of had a vision of what they wanted to achieve. Whereas yeah. you look at Tony Blair's government and the way he worked with the media, becoming Rupert, the godfather to Rupert Murdoch's children, and making a deal before the 97 election to make sure that Murdoch was on side, and in return, you know, making sure that not too much was looked into about the accumulation of power within Sky TV, etc. That's the problem, because what's happened is we've ended up with these governments that ideologically have ideology but no beliefs. And because of that, you get think tanks, and that's where the policies come from. And the think tanks are paid for by shadowy dark money. And the think tanks' opinions on things are pushed into the newspapers that then feed back into the government. So you have a system based around, you know, people working for their interests in these very shadowy ways, and then you have newspapers and newspaper columnists who express effectively the opinions of the think tanks where all their mates work, where they probably end up getting jobs. You've got people from government who immediately get jobs in the media. You've got, you know, a great example would be Stig Abel, a man who started out at the Press Complaints Authority, you know, got a job at The Sun as man, now is, you know, is a big you know, cheese at Times Radio. And the reason he's there is because, you know, he was a company man, and he did what the company wanted, and he was at The Sun long enough doing what they needed there, and they gave him the Times Literary Supplement with no interview as a kind of reward for being a good company man. So when you look at this stuff, you see that we have a broken media, because people who of talent sometimes get in, yeah, but otherwise it's company men and women.
Yeah, and of course the one entity that we haven't talked about is the BBC, which seems to operate as a kind of an amplifier for most of everything that we have talked about. How has the BBC become this? As I said, this kind of loud hailer for newspapers like the Daily Mail.
Well, I like to cleave the BBC into two parts, really, because I think you've got BBC News, which is I believe is fundamentally broken. And then on the, and then you've got BBC Entertainment and Factual and all this other kind of stuff. Like, it still makes great documentaries. It still makes a lot of great entertainment. There's a lot of great stuff on its radio. And so I try to, you know, cleave it in two like that, because yeah. I think otherwise you can get into this thing where, you know, coming from the left, I think that BBC News is broken. But then on the other hand, do I want the BBC to be destroyed as the right wants it to be? No. So to kind of try to find the way to get to that. But why are they being the way they are? Well, it's a couple of reasons. One is you've got a lot of people who were conservatives at university who claim now that they don't have any of that ideology anymore, but I think they do. Mm-hmm. Someone like Nick Robinson, who was was chair of Young Conservatives at Oxford, he says, well, those opinions are gone now, I don't have that anymore. And you think, yeah, but it's what interested you politically when you were young, and it was a formative experience. And then I listen to your questioning, and I listen to the way that you view the world and the structures, the way you believe the world to be structured, and it tastes right wing to me, yeah. You know?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Because that's the way you see the world.
I mean, it comes back to that interview with Chomsky and Ma that you were talking about, about the set of kind of institutional assumptions and values that are shared widely amongst BBC journalists.
Yeah, landlords are good, right? Landlords are good. The monarchy shouldn't be questioned. Prisons are good. The police is good. Like, all this, you can't question that. No. You know, what the police says is basically true, mm-hmm. which is bizarre as well, because you have BBC News journalists that I know are very smart people. They're investigative people. They're people who encounter time and time again examples of the police lying. But when you get the police on the Today programme, their view is all pretty much swallowed, you know, whole cloth.
Yeah.
The other issue is problem is that BBC News feels incredibly terrified, and the BBC in general feels terrified that the Conservative government are going to basically take it apart. So what they keep trying to do is sort of bending over backwards to be amenable to the right, in the hope that the crocodile will not eat them. But the crocodile just thinks, this is great. They're saying what we want them to say, but also we're still going to eat them. Because we still hate them, so it's not. There's no way to win on that one.
No, and it then alienates all those who would naturally come to the BBC's defence. And the issue as well with this kind of merry-go-round of columnists who hop between national newspaper columns and presenting TV shows like Andrew Marr, for example, or Robert Peston, there's overlap, isn't there? They're doing the same, both gigs at the same time.
Yeah, it is a problem. And the one thing you've got to think about is, like, So Tim Davey, the new, relatively new DG, Director General of the BBC, came in September last year, but so I would say still relatively new. He was a Conservative Party council candidate. The new chairman of the BBC gave £425,000 to the Conservative Party during the Cameron era. So you've got two Tory-aligned people leading the BBC now. And not that Labour didn't do the same. Gavin Davis was put in by the BBC and he was married to Sue Nye, who was a Gordon Brown advisor. So, like, both sides have done this in the past. But the problem with this as well is you have Tim Davies saying, we must be impartial. And then you have people like Justin Webb, for instance, presenter of the Today programme, writing for the Daily Mail. Or Andrew Marr writing for the Daily Mail. You know, or on the other side, on ITV, you have Robert Peston writing for The Spectator. How can these people claim to be impartial when they only ever write for nakedly right-leaning publications? You know,
you don't get them in Socialist Worker, do you? You know,
no. I mean, if someone wrote an op-ed for the Socialist Worker, or even wrote an op-ed in The Guardian, of, you know, it would be Guido Fawkes would blow his mind, and it would be, look at this lefty, blah, 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 blah. But you never get... But it's because also partly it's a linguistic thing, I think, because the right have this thing, lefty, right? And they just throw that, like, that's the ultimate insult you get. Look at this lefty, this snowflake wokist, right? But there wouldn't be an opposite. When we say, oh, he's of the right, or he's right wing, right? They go, yeah, I am. And it doesn't offend them, right? No. But lefty... Because of the media, particularly from the 70s and 80s, bashing down and saying lefty is bad, lefty is bad, lefty is bad. There's a accretion of feeling that that's a bad thing to be called, you know?
Yes. There's something really interesting about this Tory loathing of the BBC. If you kind of dial back to the 1950s, what it meant to be a Tory was the kind of the defender of the pillars of the state, you know, the civil service, the army, the judiciary, the monarchy. And one of the kind of the institutions of state throughout the 20th century has kind of been the BBC. And, you know, the fact that the BBC weighed in against the general strike, for example, and done most kind of soft propagandary kind of stuff that the government has wanted throughout its existence. It tells you something really integral about conservatism, that wanting to rip apart this and various other aspects of the establishment of the state is now an article of faith for them.
I think partly it's to do with the fact that both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have ceased to be buckets that reasonably describe what they contain anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at the schism that happened around trying to push a Brexit deal through, and that, you know, that where Dominic Cummings encouraged Boris Johnson to cut out what you would call the more wet Tories from the party, right? Mm-hmm. There is, and even now there is a much more hardline. There are these hardline groups on the back benches who are even more headbanger than anyone in the cabinet. You know, the common sense group and the COVID recovery group and all these groups. So that party's kind of broken, right? And then with Labour in the title being the party of Labour, the party of the workers, it's not anymore. It's a party of the permanent managerial class now.
Yeah.
Under Keir Starmer, and there was a kind of a bit of a swerve back under Corbyn to an attempt to be more of a, you know, party member led working class movement. To be fair, of course, or a worker movement. Because the other thing that is difficult is now, and I was trying not to go too far off the media, but the other thing that's difficult now is you look at the way the media talks about who the working class are, and they still cue to this notion that the working class is white guys in northern pit towns, right?
Yeah.
When the working class is just as much an Asian guy who works for Deliveroo,
yeah,
right? That's work. But the papers cannot think of the gig workers. They have to give them a special different name, gig workers, than to see them as working class, right? Because
yeah,
they don't like, you know, they're not kind of how the patronizing notion of the working class in the media works.
Yeah.
Just a good example for me is when someone like Dan Hodges, whose mother is the Oscar-winning actress, and whose father was a pillar of the labor movement and a big activist, tells people what working class voters think. Dan Hodges hasn't met a working class person who wasn't cleaning his loo in a very long time. No. But a communist just assumes that they know what the working class is. And to them, the working class is the working class of, at best, the early 70s.
Well, there's a there's a peculiar linguistics that you see in tabloid newspapers where they talk about criminals as lags and, pop stars having saucy romps and things. It's the kind of language that nobody has said outside of George and Mildred. This stuff is all written by graduates. It's all written by, you know, educated middle-class people. And it's not, you know, nobody wearing a flat cap with grease smears on their face.
When you enter somewhere like The Sun, they just, you just take on this lingua franca that operates there. So, you're right. And the other thing is currently they're running a campaign called Jab's Army, right? Which is obviously a play on Dad's Army. Like, obviously it's repeated a lot, it hasn't had cultural cachet really since the 70s. And you'll notice they reference a lot things from the 70s and 80s. And it's sort of, it's odd. It's like, it is a kind of time warp thing. When I break down newspaper front pages and mark them up, I always have this category, tabloidism, and it's like, it's just this certain way of talking that all newspapers have, a phraseology that it sounds mad because no normal person writes that. And when I try to write without those newspaper cliches, because they're, condemned and revealed and all this kind of stuff, it's like a lot of times you could just say said. Yeah. You know, because it's otherwise you're putting a lot of backspin on it.
Fury was another one. Mm. Furious.
Outrages, furies, romps, love rats.
Yeah, and so this itself. I mean, I do wonder these days who actually reads The Sun. I was able to answer that question to myself maybe 20 years ago. And it was, when I trained as a junior reporter, the burnt out hack who was our lecturer, he said, it's lads on their lunch break. But I don't think that's true. The last time I saw a copy of The Sun, it was on a table in a hairdresser's, and that was it. So I don't know how it makes its money. It seems to be, as you say, this anachronistic thing in the 21st century. It's really,
well, I mean, it makes its money through a diversification of things it does. Sun Bingo, Sun Racing, Sun Bet, like all this kind of stuff. Who still reads it? Well, yeah, I would say people who want a paper that's kind of like, it's got the news, but it's kind of, it's aggressively entertaining in a sense, right? But basically, if you, one way of knowing who how the Mirror, the Sun and the Star operate, right, is what they say on their front covers. So at the moment, for the past year or so, the Sun has been going with 25 pence cheaper than the Mirror, right?
Yeah.
And then the Mirror is trying to sort of say, well, we're the kind of thinking person's red top. And then the Star has gone down this line of, it's still as reactionary as it ever was inside, but on the front page now it does these funny covers, which works quite well for it because people sort of go, that's funny, so people pay more attention to it. When you open it up, it's still got page three. It's also got all sorts of stuff that's, it's highly reactionary. But that, who reads it? People who will just pick up a paper that costs less than a quid.
Yeah,
that's the market now. It's like, I want something to read and it costs less than a quid. And I don't say that in any kind of sneering way. But the thing that bothers me in some ways as well is that The Sun used to have more craft to its, to how it was made. Like, one of the things The Sun was obviously very renowned for was these funny-ish seeming headlines, or clever headlines. They've sort of gone. Most headlines aren't that great in there. It's kind of done by rote. It's like we were saying about these 70s, 60s, 80s references. The headlines sort of feel a bit old and passé, and it's like, you know, you'd find 500 puns on Twitter that about any topic that are better than anything the Sun is putting in there. And then one of the reasons is because they don't, you know, they've reduced the number of staff. A lot of the most talented people aren't there anymore, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's, I always remember reading Nick Davis saying basically that the newspapers are run by accountants now. And, you know,
yeah.
So the most sort of fearsome weapon of the kind of the reactionary tabloid right really is the Daily Mail, that seems to, I mean, that has a far greater ability to set agendas than any of the red tops anymore, I would argue.
The Daily Mail is the most powerful paper, I think, and one of the reasons is, well, the Daily Mail is good. If you're someone who would judge their paper by how much you get in it, is it a good read in terms of do I get, how much volume of material do I get? The Daily Mail has tons to read in it every day. And the Daily Mail is appealing to like a middle England type audience, you know, mostly older, late 50s through to 80s, you know. But it's odd because it's very salacious in some ways. And often it's more salacious than the Sun. It's obsessed with sex in TV shows. And it's sort of like for people who don't know how to search for porn on the internet. It's like, look, here are all these screenshots of, like, nudity from a TV series. Isn't it appalling? Like, get your magnifying glass out so you can, you know, count how many nipples are on this screenshot. Like, it's bizarre, but it's The Sun isn't very well made anymore. It was always evil, by the way. I don't want people to think I was saying, oh, it was great. But it used to be, well, very tightly constructed. It's not anymore. The Daily Mail is rigorously tightly constructed. Like, it is a ruthless editorial product because it just knows what is my... It angles... It knows an angle every time, and it knows how to manipulate the emotions of its readers very effectively, and it's why it still sells very well, and it's why Mail Online is the most, you know, toxically addictive online product.
Yeah, and so they have an ability to speak to the target audiences in a way that's generally far more effective than either of our two political parties, and communicating a very clear, a very narrow message.
But one thing I would say, because there's something that you said earlier that we kind of we got off topic with slightly, which is like you said, well, why does the BBC keep run to the agenda of these things? It's because we have still got this really weird, old-fashioned, I think, system where at the end of every day there's a newspaper review on BBC News Channel, Sky News. The papers are looked at in Newsnight. And at the beginning of every day, those newspapers are used to fill the editorial, you know, the running order of the Today programme, Good Morning Britain, Your Call on 5 Live, LBC. So it is this cycle of things. The papers push stories into the eyes of the broadcasters. And then the broadcasters chew up those stories over the day, which then ends up in the papers again. So, you know, you can have stuff banging or running for 4, 5, 6 days in a row because the broadcast rounds have created stuff. So, you know, Piers Morgan exists to feed the papers. The papers exist to feed Piers Morgan. Same thing with the Today programme, allegedly in a more highbrow manner, but I don't see it because at least Morgan will put his, you know, foot on the neck of a politician every now and then.
Cool. Well, that's kind of drawing us to the end of our chat, I think. Thanks so much for coming on, Nick.
No worries, man.
And I do hope I'd like to do more of this kind of this kind of focus later on. So I do hope you'll join us again. And yes, thanks very much. And
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.